Welcome everybody to Wednesday's speaker series talks. We have actually three speakers in total today, two for you this morning and then one later this afternoon. For this morning, I am very excited to introduce on my new dual monitor. Make sure I have my notes here. Cool. So we have two speakers for you today speaking around living spaces and housing design innovation. So we have Taylor Kane, the director of the Housing Innovation Lab, who has her PhD and is an urban sociologist who writes about cities and families and gentrification, heads up the Mayor's Housing Innovation Lab for the city of Boston. And her work and research hopes to move us closer to the creation of diverse and inclusive urban environments. And also on the call with us today is Wendy Pascal, who is a Housing Innovation Design Fellow, so works with Taylor and explores housing design and how housing and design and policy come together. As I said, she's part of the Mayor's Housing Innovation Lab and oversees the effort using innovative design to create more affordable housing throughout Boston and aims to center the many voices of Boston residents and their complex experiences to ultimately drive design and implementation for future affordable homes and neighborhoods in the city. So with that, Monique, I'll hand it off to you.
Thank you so much for the introduction, Greg. Hey, Wendy and Taylor, thank you so much for being here. It's awesome to see you again, even if it is just in a virtual environment. Taylor and Wendy have been involved with Accelerate and with Wentworth now for the last year, I would say, when we initially met at one of our think tanks, and both of them were heavily involved in working with Professor Ellis last semester on a studio that actually explored the triple decker, and we'll be diving into that a little bit in a while. So thank you so much for being part of the Future Lab.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Excited to be here.
So I'd love to just dive in. We are all in this extremely surreal environment at the moment. And, you know, that's how our students are also currently experiencing the space, because most of them are architecture students. We have some students from computer science and networking and some students from mathematics. And, you know, they are in this environment because, you know, obviously architecture has been taking a hit, like the built environment has been taking a hit. Now, I'm curious to hear from you how you are perceiving the future at this moment, just in very general terms.
Really starting us off with an easy softball question. What do we think about the future in this moment? I mean, quite honestly, I think as we think about the future right now, I'm somewhat torn, because it feels as though there are a couple of narratives or rhetorics that we have about this moment, that this is really a chance. There's a kind of a set of folks who are looking at this moment as really presenting an opportunity. So an opportunity to try out different things, to kind of get things off the ground that we have always been hoping to do, which I can understand and hold, that there is a lot about this time that is really making some of the ideas that we once thought were impossible suddenly seem possible. And so I think it's important to hold and recognize that. But I think there is also another framing that we can hold about this moment and what it means about the future, is that this right now is very much a moment of reckoning. Like, we are in a time where so many of the longstanding inequalities that we've always known have existed in our cities, in our country, globally, are really being brought to bear, are very evident in this moment. And so this moment can both be an opportunity, but is also a reckoning for us to really decide how we want to move forward, how we can move forward. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important to recognize that what we do now in our response will have longstanding impacts as we think mm-hmm. about the recovery and even what happens after the recovery process.
Wendy, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think to Taylor's point about reckoning, that it really has been a moment for a lot of us to really think about the different values that we think about instituting, and what are the values that we're going to continue to hold on to, and what are the ones that really need some reconsideration or should just be sort of placed in the background altogether. And I think that it's a way that we've, Taylor and I, have been thinking about this work really intentionally as well.
Now, you have been diving into this straight away, so let's get at it, because I think it's important that the Innovation Lab was actually formed because you have been charged with looking at the inequalities that are existing across the city and how you actually serve all constituencies in a way that provides prosperity and housing security. And so I'm curious to hear, like, what have been the biggest challenges that you focused on before, and how have those challenges, you know, potentially now shifted? Because you just brought up that anything we do today, you know, may have been thought of impossible before, but now it might become possible. And it also has huge impact on how we are moving forward in the future. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. And so I would start by saying that I don't think any of our priorities have changed, or the way in which we think about the city, think about housing. I don't think Wandy and I have had kind of this like radical restructuring of how we think about the role of the lab and the role that we play in kind of pushing our conversations about housing. I do think that is a connecting thread if we want to kind of break down kind of pre-COVID and where we are right now. I do think that over the past few months, we have started to think about how we reframe some of the conversations that we were having. So Wandy can speak a bit more about the triple-decker, future-decker work. But even as we have conversations and explore projects around things like additional dwelling units, I think we still see those types of solutions as a way of enabling folks to really stay and age in place as opportunities for wealth building. Those are things that we will continue to need, that we needed before this moment, we need during this moment, and we will need for the foreseeable future. But I think it also adds an additional dimension where ADUs present this way in which folks who are perhaps in intergenerational households can still stay together but have separate types of spaces. So it just brings, we're adding kind of additional layers to some of the projects that were already underway.
Can you dive a little bit deeper into those layers? And maybe Wandy was about to do that, because I think that's really interesting. And then we are learning right now what those layers are potentially going to look like that we have to worry about.
And so something that I'm definitely thinking about, and Taylor mentioned this with the future decker work, that we were having community conversations earlier on this year with folks about their triple decker experiences and how they would envision this future decker. The way that we've sort of had to pivot during this period of COVID-19 really highlighted the ways that we engage with people and what does that look like through a virtual scape, and how can we actually continue to be in conversations with folks that might not have internet access, that might not be you know, on different social media platforms and that sort of thing. So we really noticed that there was a lot less turnout with some of the engagement that we had put out there, and really rethinking how we can actually continue that. How can we sort of like go back to some of the ways that really engage with people in a more physical space, like putting up flyers and that sort of thing. And I think that process is something that we often think about with a lot of the different projects that we work on. And that's always something that we just want to continue to rethink and reframe and really meet people where they are.
Because many of those community conversations are actually crucial to city planning and how you are actually considering housing solutions. So what have been some ideas that you've developed or that you've iterated on to actually reach those audiences and be able to pull some of their feedback into the equation?
Yeah, so we have been thinking a lot about signage and what that can look like and what it can do, especially during this time. We know that there's a lot of folks who sort of go out into the streets for, you know, getting just getting like fresh air and that sort of thing. And we, I think at some point I had sort of like underestimated the value in that, but really had to think about how can we actually continue to do some of these things that might not ask for folks to congregate in large numbers at like a community center or a library, but what are the safe ways that we can continue to do that?
Mm-hmm. Can you maybe share a little bit more about the future DECA project? Because I don't think that all the students that have been part of it are aware. And as a result of that, right, maybe talk a little bit about the demographical shifts that you've been seeing in the neighborhoods. Taylor brought up, you know, you actually brought up aging in place is one of the biggest pieces. Then, you know, also thinking about now you have a lot more single households or young professionals, and how does that scale? How do you deal with intergenerational housing? So can you share a little bit more about some of those demographic challenges that you're hoping to address?
Yeah, so triple deckers are, you know, this iconic New England vernacular typology. And it's one that we really wanted to sort of learn more about and explore and have these conversations with folks to get a better understanding as to how they have provided affordable housing opportunities for families, how they are sort of also this example of what multifamily and multi-generational housing can look like in the city of Boston. We know that in recent years, there's been a shift of those demographics. Like you mentioned, Monique, we know that there's a lot of students and younger professionals sort of occupying these previously created like family households. And what's been interesting about these conversations that we've been naming as future decker conversations, right, is to really get a sense of like, if you're to recreate and continue to build these building types in the city of Boston, what are the things that we really need to take into consideration to do that? And how can residents themselves speak about what their needs and their wants are so that we can plan accordingly and build accordingly? And so it's been interesting with some of the conversations that we've had, because there's really been a range of folks in terms of age, in terms of how long they've lived in these triple deckers. And so some of the things that they've wanted to see and some of the outcomes that they would like to see actually share a lot of similarities. So we're talking about, you know, making them a little bit more affordable. Is that sort of like increasing and adding an additional unit? A lot of people have talked about the need for outdoor space, and, you know, triple deckers are known for their balconies. So is there something that can also be implemented? And then other folks have been talking about this sort of like mixed use component. How can we talk about small businesses in relationship to housing so that it's less disconnected?
You know, I think that was interesting when we actually saw some of the proposals from the students that, you know, the sites that were picked actually were along Blue Hill Avenue. And so as a result, you know, you had a lot more mixed use housing, which was really kind of interesting. And so when you think back at some of the models that were proposed, which ones would you consider, you know, the most progressive, that really push the guidelines and the policies, you know, that have been in place as part of the city and could really provide a new path forward?
Yeah. So I'll also speak a little bit. It was, you know, a really great experience to have partnered with John Ellis's class and to have heard from the students what they were noticing about the sort of like housing disparities. Some of them have also lived in triple deckers. And this moment to explore the future decker was really interesting, because for the course, they actually had to create mission statements for each of the different buildings. And something that was really noticeable about how the students took on this work was their intentionality and really thinking about already existing neighborhood groups and associations in the neighborhoods of Dorchester and on that part of Blue Hill Ave, and how they then decided to create intentional like user groups and then create a program around the sort of like different building types. Some of the ones that come to mind are the ones that really push for this multi-generational approach, and also have, right, there were a lot of like maker spaces, and thinking about how people can essentially build their own housing on their own and really create this sense of autonomy. And that's something that really came through in a lot of the work that they produced.
I have a question around the multi-generational housing pieces, because it is something that I've always been fantasizing about. And, you know, I do think as I'm getting older, perhaps, you know, the idea of communal living seems so much more attractive. However, you know, with COVID-19, that certainly has thrown some sort of a wrench into it. Any of those community spaces, like co-working spaces, maker spaces, you know, how do you deal with multiple generations that are occupying the same space? Would we have to consider separations? How do you think about this now? Has that changed, like, some of those perspectives?
Yeah, so I can get us started on that, as we have a project around intergenerational home share that is ongoing, where we've been working with our partner agency, Nesterly, to really connect older homeowners and renters in Boston with younger folks who are interested in an intergenerational living arrangement. And so in March, as things were starting to change in terms of the landscape, we started to think really seriously about intergenerational home share and how it would need to change given the landscape that we were navigating, and the fact that older adults are a particularly vulnerable population in this moment. And so it was interesting that we actually heard much of the concern from renters who had initially expressed interest in doing intergenerational home share, hesitancy among that population, and concern about potentially exposing older adults who would be sharing their homes to COVID. And we actually heard from some older adults that they were still interested in sharing their homes in this way, but being concerned about the potential transmission that could take place in those intergenerational arrangements. So what we ended up doing, which I think is actually pretty interesting, is we really thought deeply about what the core kind of tenets and values of intergenerational home share were and what we were trying to achieve. And so I think it was really about fostering social connection across generations, in addition to creating more housing opportunities in the city. But in this moment, it felt like actually really leaning into the social connection piece could be really helpful. And so we worked with our partner to make a bit of a pivot and actually figure out a way of creating a platform that allowed folks who typically would have been renters in intergenerational living situations to actually serve a role as being volunteers for older adults who needed help with grocery delivery, with medicine pickup, or just wanted a phone call to talk to someone else outside of their household. And so it's been really exciting to see the interest both from older adults and from other folks in the city who really want to be a part of this, and to still maintain to still figure out a way of fostering connection across generations in this moment where it can feel really isolating for many different types of people, but particularly for our older adults and vulnerable populations for whom going outside poses very significant risks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. It's interesting, like, how an original space solution has turned into more of a programmatic solution at that point. And we actually tomorrow have Andrea Burns come in from the Age Strong initiative at the city. And and she is just coming off a summit in the morning that talks about isolation in seniors. And so that will just be a continuation, because now we are suddenly all experience isolation. And so I think there is a lot to be learned, like going back to what are actually the values, what are we trying to accomplish when we are creating those shared housing units, and could those values be transmitted in other ways? So thanks for sharing that programmatic approach. Now, you mentioned before that this time also creates a lot of opportunity, and I'm always in the space, like I always love to perceive, you know, challenges as opportunities. And so I would love to hear how you would think of different housing models that have been percolating in your mind, but that just seemed really super hard to implement. How can you accelerate them now? Like, how can you put them into the environment, and what do you need to make that happen?
So I would take it a step back, because I don't think it's about kind of the ideas that like we've been thinking about, but like suddenly this is the time to really realize them. I think the approach that we're taking is, what are the problems that we are trying to solve for? And then what are the solutions that actually get to making some type of impact on the problems that we're interested in? And we 100% recognize that as a lab who takes this approach of prototype-driven policy, the likelihood that a pilot project that we do radically transforms decades of historical inequities and inequality is just not realistic. But I do think we play a role of thinking about the incremental change that needs to take place in order to get us to a point where we are actually able to really unpack and dismantle what are very deep-seated issues. So I like to do that bit of framing before talking about some of the things that we work on. But I think right now, one of the things that we are really trying to sort through is that we had a housing crisis before COVID. We are still in one, and we'll be in one for the foreseeable future. And so wanting to hold the importance of thinking about all of the existing housing that we have and how we make sure that we're supporting renters in this moment, that we are fostering ways of renters and other folks in the housing ecosystem to have really honest conversations with one another. But we also want to be thinking about production and ensuring that we continue to create new opportunities for housing across Boston neighborhoods. And so how can we start to dismantle the longstanding residential racial segregation that exists in our city? And I think the ways in which we think about that is, how can we bring greater predictability and flexibility to the development process? And so I'll let Wandy talk about a workshop that we have coming up next week that is really trying to get to some of these questions. But I think those are the two pieces that we're holding right now. This interest in continuing the work that we were doing around the existing housing that we have, and how do we reimagine it and help it work better for the folks who are currently living there, but also holding the need for additional, like, new types of housing and new opportunities for housing. How do we get there as well?
Great. Thank you for framing it that way. We've always preaching to our students to love the problem. So I appreciate that you've been leading with this. And, you know, I think for me, it was like a hidden call to action for the students. Like, if they can support in any ways, you know, some of those ideas, or, you know, tackle some of those challenges that you are facing as they're going further into the future lab. And that could be helpful for you to maybe quick and dirty prototype things. That is definitely an opportunity.
Yeah. And so, to Taylor's point about really getting this better sense of how we can increase housing production in the city, and asking folks who are doing this work right now and getting a better understanding of what the development process hurdles and barriers really look like in this current moment. So the workshop that Taylor mentioned next week is titled Distributing Density. And we know that this is a, right, density is a topic that typically comes up in a lot of different housing conversations. And especially now, it's something that a lot of folks have really been talking about from the health perspective. And it's something that we also want to really unpack, because we recognize that it isn't just density that is a potential issue. It's typically, how does it affect different populations? How does it displace populations as well? And so the type of density that we actually want to talk about is middle scale density, and how we can really allow for the creation of sustainable neighborhoods in the city. This is a way for us to have this, to join in on this like greater national conversation around the missing middle, and really getting a sense of what does that look like in Boston, and what are the different barriers and hurdles that folks really face when they're trying to create this type of building scale. And walkable neighborhoods is something that, you know, a lot of us have been talking about over the years. And so is there an opportunity for, you know, different middle scale typologies to really facilitate the creation of walkable neighborhoods and healthy neighborhoods as well? And so that's something that we'll be exploring next week with a lot of different folks in different areas and professions, and really coming together to test respond to this request for ideas so that we can get as many solutions as possible in the room.
Now, is the workshop that you just mentioned, is that open potentially for our students as well? Like, you can sign up because it happens virtually, and so the participant number doesn't matter as much?
So we're keeping the number a little bit small this time around, but it will be recorded, and then we'll be sharing out the information and the different outcomes. But there will be a request for ideas to be released later this summer. And we're actually asking as many people to sort of apply to that as possible, because we want to make this a crowdsourcing opportunity so that we're all collectively thinking about this issue.
Okay, that's awesome. Thank you. We saw yesterday that Greenovate also has an event happening next week. And so some of the students are interested in participating there as well. And so one of the approaches of the Future Lab has been to give them as many insights into different verticals that are pertaining to the way how we live in the future. And so come up with ideas that could potentially support any of your verticals as well. And so, you know, if that could become like a mutual, coalition, I think that would be fantastic. I think we have a bunch of questions already percolating in the chat. So let me hop over there. There is one from Kyle coming this fall. A lot of leases will not be signed by incoming college students as predicted from COVID. Could we see a housing market collapse, and or could we be proactive in possibly tackling the housing crisis in Boston through this low rental need? Or do we see it as counterproductive to affect students?
Yeah, I mean, so many layers of questions there. And that is frankly a huge concern at this moment in terms of thinking about how our housing market will be impacted come this fall, what it will look like. There are a lot of unknowns in this moment that make it really challenging to think about what we should do. I will say that one of the things that we do see as an area that could potentially experience some positive impact in this moment is that because of the exodus of students and this uncertainty around whether students will come back in the fall, it does give folks who have vouchers, so voucher holders, some greater flexibility and frankly power in the rental market because they are coming with a funding source that is backed by whether it's the state or the federal government. And so there is, I think that we are looking to that as a potential way to get more voucher holders into housing across the city, because from a landlord property owner perspective, will be really appealing to have a tenant that is going to, their rent is basically guaranteed for the foreseeable future.
Okay, thank you, Tyler. There is another question from Bradley. The inflation in Boston has limited lower income communities from being able to live in some housing in Boston. I personally know that my triple decker apartment doesn't have anybody renewing the lease after September. Is there any way to contact local landlords to negotiate prices so that lower income communities have the option to move into more reliable housing?
Yeah, so I think there's actually some connections between the question that we just went through and this kind of talking about how we can potentially direct more voucher holders into some of the housing that we have in Boston, looking at all of the different neighborhoods of the city. So those conversations are already having, and we're increasing the amount of vouchers that are available to residents in Boston. So that will be something that we will continue to see develop over the course of the next few months. But there is this rather large and scary looming question around the ability for tenants who don't have access to vouchers or aren't in subsidized housing, around their ability to continue paying rent, especially if we have folks who are experiencing a reduction in job hours or perhaps losing their income, the increase in like childcare time that folks are spending at this now also having an impact on work ability. So there are a lot of questions around what will happen if we just have this ever-growing number of renters who aren't able to pay rent. There will be extreme and significant ripple effects of that throughout our housing market.
So sorry, I actually live right next to like a Section 8 housing, and like I know like a lot of the community is there because they can't really afford the housing around us. And I've worked in an architecture firm that's made affordable housing near here, and the affordable ability of it is not very affordable, especially for like an income that I'm making. Do you think it would be better to work on the communities and give back to the communities in a better way, or to create the opportunity for people to actually leave these communities?
Sorry, I was starting to say that I think I kicked off this conversation by talking about kind of the multiple frames that exist about this moment. This is similarly another area where there are competing schools of thought. I think there are competing schools of thought, but I think that we have to do both, that we have to invest in communities that have been historically underinvested and marginalized and create opportunities for community power and autonomy. But we also have to create opportunities for folks to express autonomy. And so sometimes that means staying in a particular place, and sometimes that means moving somewhere else. I think both of those things have to happen simultaneously to really give people the opportunity to truly experience choice and not feel as though their choice is constrained, because to stay in a particular place means that their outcomes as it relates to educational attainment, potential projected future earnings, that is not determined by the place that you live, which is currently the case. We need to get to a future where you live does not determine your life outcomes.
If you could construct that future, what would it entail?
What would that entail?
Yeah, so what kind of levers would we have to move? Like if you think of no constraints and you could be completely audacious, because the students are going to develop future scenarios. So, you know, think about, you know, 2030, if those constraints would be lifted, like what would the future look like?
In the future, every neighborhood and city would have affordable housing. And so that's both like capital A affordable in terms of subsidized by whether it's federal government, state government, local government, but also affordable in the sense of it is affordable to folks who aren't able to receive different types of government assistance. I think that would dramatically change our landscape if there was a more just distribution of housing across Boston, but also across the US.
So one of the things that brings it up for students as well, and they're going to dive deeper into this, is like some of the drivers and the forces that are at work that currently prevent that from happening, right, in terms of social security, in terms of, you know, how what are the governmental structures, policies, and systems that are connecting into these issues and not creating that future scenario as a possibility. So I think it's interesting to not only look at this is where we want to be, but also what is holding us currently back. It's just so much more entangled than a simple direct line path. Okay, we have one more question coming in from Alexis. After witnessing the social inequalities of Boston with the foreclosures and schools taking over communities like Roxbury, how can we utilize abandoned buildings to help those affected by these foreclosures and evictions? Not to be used as homeless shelters, but to create homes for them in buildings like abandoned mills, shopping malls, factories, and other places that aren't dilapidated.
Yeah, that's a great question, and makes me think about not just Boston, but the greater Boston area in terms of this area's history. We have lots of mill buildings or these old industrial buildings that are in some cases not serving a functional use in this moment because those industries have changed. So we are seeing that in some places outside of Boston where new life is coming to these underutilized older buildings. I think when we think about Boston itself, our landscape is a bit different, but I do think there is space to consider space differently and think about how we use the spaces that we do have access to as a city. So we think a lot about how we as a city can kind of put our resources where our mouth is in terms of how we're using city-owned buildings and properties. So we have an initiative called Housing with Public Assets, where we're looking at things like our libraries, fire stations, and municipal parking lots, and asking how we can deepen the value of those spaces by adding housing on top or next to. And so when I say value, it's not just about kind of the financial value of this space, but I mean like the value for residents, the value for our city in terms of having a space to call home, but also having a space that allows for this interaction between different parts of the public sphere. So to live atop a library affords all of these opportunities for interaction with your neighbors, with librarians, access to different types of resources that is really appealing. So I think that we right now are starting to have different types of conversations about how we want to use spaces across the city. And that's kind of one example of a way in which we're doing that.
Wendy, would you like to add anything to that? Because you were nodding.
Yeah, I've just been thinking also a lot about, especially when it comes to malls and mill buildings, that as much as a lot of our sort of like neighboring regional municipalities have also been looking into ways to create housing in those, it has oftentimes also come at the expense of, you know, housing costs and housing affordability. So it would be something that I think with Housing with Public Assets, that when you sort of look at the different right costs that need to be considered for the creation of affordable housing, that land value is typically one of those. And so when you sort of like account for these different costs, you can really in the end game sort of lower the costs overall for housing. So
I also wonder how the situation is going to change if you know, we are working more remote, and then some companies might actually not consider renting as much space anymore as they have previously. And that would also free up additional space in cities potentially. Okay, there's one other question from Kyle. In the city thinking, is the city thinking of further solutions regarding rent relief grants for the coming future?
So I unfortunately have to jump off, but I'll get us started by saying that the city has created a rental relief fund that was first announced in early April. We had over 5,500 Bostonians apply for that initial bucket of funding that was administered through a lottery process. And then today, actually, we have reopened the fund with additional investment. And so we'll be continuing to serve renters who have been financially impacted by COVID and providing up to $4,000 in rental assistance, which would cover around 3 months of rent for tenants at this time. So if folks have any questions about that particular fund, please feel free to reach out via email. And thanks so much again for holding the space. Apologies that I have to head off to another call.
Thanks so much for
being
here.
Thank you so much, Taylor.
It was wonderful seeing you. We have one question, more rhetorical, from Kyle. Yesterday, Tito Jackson mentioned at the BLM vigil in Franklin Park that Roxbury has a 30-year lower life expectancy rate to Back Bay. Only a few miles apart, it struck me as shocking and another situation that is being brought to attention. When we looked at the triple deckers and when we tried to figure out what sites would be best, that was actually quite startling. And early on last week, we had a talk by one of our professors, Ella Howard, who showed us some of the historical maps and how some of those disparities like still are kind of in effect in many ways. And so Wandy, I know you've spent some time on that. Would you be able to comment?
Yeah, I think that especially at a moment like this where we're talking about a global health crisis, that when we really start to notice it is sort of like intersectional approaches and how these different things are really interconnected every step of the way. And so with a lot of the work, part of our own pivoting has been to really highlight the different health disparities, especially when we talk about middle-scale housing. I think that it, with the Blue Hill Ave parcel specifically, a lot of the different empty parcels that we were looking at for that course had their own historical attachments. We know that there was a history of white flight also in that area. And how have we sort of continued to really try to invest in different efforts. And so this Blue Hill Ave, those parcels were chosen for the course for the triple decker and the future decker course, precisely because DND, the Department of Neighborhood Development, is really thinking about how to create new housing opportunities on that street, on that road, and to really have an interdepartmental conversation with other departments like transportation. There's a planning process in the neighborhood of Mattapan right now, and how do we think about continuing to reinvest in those neighborhoods at a time like this?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Bradley had another question. If you own a home and make your payments on time, you build credit. And this credit allows you to build a future of income for yourself. Do you think if rent helped build credit, lower income communities would have more opportunities? That's a great question. It also kind of actually goes to the driving forces that are underlying many of those processes and policies.
Yeah. So we at the lab have really taken a lot of time to think about what renter equity looks like in the city. We know that we have a high percentage of renters here as well. And so we recognize the sort of value in home ownership, but we also want to highlight and not discourage folks from continuing to be renters. We know that there's a lot of stigma that is associated with renters. And so we've also been thinking and looking at other cities that have examples of what that can look like. So I'm thinking about this co-housing project in Barcelona, Spain, called La Borda, that really actually allows, we often think about co-housing examples as home ownership opportunities, but this particular one is actually for renters, and there's this sort of equity that they put into place, this value that they offer at the start of it. And there can be a lot of different ways that renters can also give back to their community. And we know that folks already do that, whether they attend community meetings or they participate in different volunteer opportunities in their own neighborhoods, whether they're a part of community gardening groups and et cetera. And so how do we really attach a value to that is represented economically as well?
Thank you for sharing that. We've heard last week the block the super block concept from Barcelona. And so it would be interesting to actually look at La Borda to learn more about how that renter equity could be something that perhaps is translatable. We have one question from Olivia here. What are some of the major holes that have been exposed in the socioeconomic fabric of Boston, even greater because of COVID-19?
Yeah, I think that there's been a lot of inequities that have really come to light. You know, as we were instating the rental relief fund, that we were really intentional in listening to how a lot of folks we have, right, the nation is going through its record number of unemployment. And so how are folks sort of able to continue to pay their rent and stay in their housing? We had to place eviction moratoriums to really prevent landlords from evicting different folks, different residents as well. And of course, health disparities and how it's been disproportionately affecting communities of color. We've been taking a look at, I think, this question around density, right? That we have a limited sort of like housing stock. And, you know, it's something that we continue to talk about housing production, but there is a difference of communities that experience overcrowded housing versus those that don't. And typically those that are experiencing overcrowding situations that are in overcrowded situations are communities of color as well. So it's something that we continue to work towards addressing.
Okay. You spoke a lot about co-creation, and I know it's very important to you to actually come up with solution from the ground up and involving the community so it becomes most useful. What is an opportunity for students or for starting young professionals to actually become part of that conversation?
Oh, for sure. Especially as a young person as well, trying to figure out how to continue to be a part of the community that I'm a part of. I think I typically have not undermine, but I really like to highlight the sort of importance in making your own voice heard in when there are different processes taking place. There are a lot of different Boston neighborhoods that are undergoing planning initiatives at the moment, and they host a series of community meetings. The BBDA has been conducting some virtually now, and we also know that there's a lot of different community development corporations, that there are different community organizations that host these meetings and really advocate for how residents should be speaking up. And we know that at community meetings, there's a disparity of the age demographics that is at play, and different forms of demographics as well. And so I would tell any and all young people to attend those meetings to make your voices heard so that you're also voicing the sort of disparities that you experience personally that might not get highlighted in the planning process.
Yeah, and that's also a great recommendation to learn more about what the challenges are for your neighbors and other people in the community as we're thinking about empathetic approaches and how do you walk in someone else's shoes. You really can't unless you're starting to have that dialogue and learn. There has been one more question from Thomas. One day, my family used to own a triple decker in Roxbury where they occupied and owned the entire structure. Recently, I have discovered that like many other buildings, each floor in the building is now owned by a different landlord. How much of a hurdle has this been when trying to create new intergenerational housing or providing housing opportunities within a single structure?
Yeah, triple deckers have been an interesting one just because of the cost differences that have taken place in the last few decades. And so we know that there's been a shift to the creation of condos in triple deckers. It's interesting because I actually wouldn't say that there's been as great of, I've seen differences and different kinds of representation as to who owns these different units. So there, a lot of them do still have this intergenerational component to them, but it does look very different as to the ability for renters to then be a part of that process and those build and to live within those building structures as well. And so we've been sort of looking into ways to continue to advocate for you know, having folks both own the building and then rent the other units out and create a more sort of like stable environment in that sense. But it is really difficult to purchase one single triple decker at a time like this. They go for, you know, in the like millions of dollars sort of realm. And so how do you even incentivize a small homeowner, a small landlord to try to purchase a triple decker at a time like this to then try to make the numbers work and create affordable rental opportunities for the folks that would be able to live there?
Yeah, I can definitely see that this is a challenging proposition, even if you're considering from a city perspective to really shift the way how triple deckers are being constructed. So many have been absorbed right away from developers and you know turned over into fairly expensive condo units. So really just maximizing the value of the building has superseded the actual, you know, social impact or ethical decision-making. And, you know, what role do you think the city can play in that regard? Like, is it just through regulations? Is it like, how do you actually foster, you know, the active shaping of that neighborhood?
Yeah, I think that there have to be different folks at play when we think about this. I think that we have had conversations about what regulations for that can actually look like, what sort of like ways to think about limit values and that sort of thing. We know that there's only so many ways that we can play around with how the market operates, but there are ways that we can try to continue to incentivize. And so I'm even thinking about this request for ideas proposal and thinking about what, right, if it's not one person trying to purchase a triple decker, then can there be a way to try to make the numbers work if there's a collective sort of like purchasing a number of them and then trying to figure out how to make the costs work in their favor as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea that comes back into play, especially if families are more displaced than they potentially have been in previous, you know, decades. Thinking about how you now potentially purchase one building together with friends and create just different living arrangements. Because if you're living far away from your families, right, now suddenly your friends become your support structure. And then what would that do in terms of different neighborhoods?
Yeah.
Wendy, it was fabulous to have you here today. There's one more question from Bradley. How does Alpha Management play into this where they own thousands of apartments? It's a good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. It's also getting me to think about how we think about folks that own either a lot of land or even large employers. And we've had conversations with large employers to try to figure out how they create housing opportunities for not just their employees, but other folks and residents in the city as well. And I think that there are ways to continue to have conversations with those that, you know, have amounted to a lot in the city and how they can continue to help the rest of the residents here as well.
Thank you, Wendy, for being here. You've been like such an amazing supporter to the students I know in the last studio. They loved you. And, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time and being here with us. And please extend our thanks again to Taylor as well. You've been doing an amazing job as part of the Housing Innovation Lab. And we are really fortunate to have you in the city. So thank you for participating in the Future Lab.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Yeah. And take care, everybody.
Bye. Take care.